Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Ashes to Ashes. In this five-part series from The Telegraph, we remember five iconic Ashes tests. Two rival players who took centre stage will relive their roles in one of the longest-running duels in sporting history. Ashes to Ashes. Sydney 1971. With Geoffrey Boycott.
We were regarded as, hang on, are they going to beat us in Australia in our own backyard? And we got called this dad's army and they thought we weren't very good, to be honest, which was a mistake.
And Ian Chappell.
As a player, you never think that you're beaten until you are actually beaten. I always thought that around that time, the Sydney pitch was the best cricket pitch in the world. It gave everybody a chance.
And is he out? Yes, it's all over. He's caught. The wicket has fallen. Snow has taken 7 for 40.
Shil Berry, The Telegraph's cricket correspondent. It was an amazing victory, the fourth test at Sydney. England's top three were Geoffrey Boycott in his prime, Ryan Lakehurst of Kent, and that nuggety left-hander, John Edridge. Thanks to these three, and tail-wagging led by Raymond Illingworth and John Snow, England's total was just about par at 332. Australia were into the last days of Bill Laurie's captaincy, and it showed. In England's second innings, Geoffrey Boycott batted for almost 7 hours and ruled out any Australian recovery. Now the pitch was wearing, and everyone expected Illingworth and Derek Underwood to cash in again. It never happened. John Snow was too hostile. He had the great ability to bang the ball in, not much short of a length, and to make it kick around the batsman's ribs and unhelmeted heads. England 1-0 up with three to play.
Ashes to Ashes. Paul Hayward, Telegraph chief sports writer.
After a cancelled tour of South Africa and a trip to Pakistan that was abandoned midway through, English cricket finished the 1960s in good health. Both the West Indies and New Zealand were seen off at home, and England set off for a seven-test tour to Australia with the aim of winning back the Ashes after six failed attempts. But after arriving for their four-month tour, England, playing as the MCC, struggled in the warm-up games. Australia, badly defeated by South Africa earlier in the year, were finding a way back to their usual imperious Ashes form. Here's Geoffrey Boycott.
Personally, I didn't concentrate much on the opposition. I've always been a great believer that you should concentrate much more on your own form. Get your own form playing well, your confidence up, get yourself mentally right to perform. Then you can think about the opposition.
Well, in 1970-71, Australia was struggling a bit. We beat India in India in 1969, but then we were sold up the river by the Australian Cricket Board and sent straight on to South Africa, who were then a very, very good side, and we lost 4-0 there. Now, they weren't a 4-0 better side, but we were pretty well done after the tour of India. So we were coming off some bad losses in South Africa. So really, Australian cricket was at a bit of a low ebb at that point. The interest in the game of cricket in Australia always pretty strong, probably wanes a little bit when we're losing, but there was still pretty great interest in the series.
We had experience. John Edwards was a wonderful player, left-hander for Surrey. He averaged about 70-odd in the series. Brian Lukers was probably in his pomp. I know he was 32 and what, but he was a seasoned campaigner with Kent. They'd won one-day competitions. Good player. We weren't phased. And I'll tell you, Dolly Vera was one of the best waiters I've ever seen in my life as a batsman. By that, if you bat in the middle order, You sit with your pads on waiting to bat next man in. You don't know whether you're going to be in 5 minutes or 5 hours. And that can take its toll of some players. He had a way of just letting everything go. Just sat quietly. Didn't bother him. Didn't smoke. He didn't drink a lot. Certainly not when he was in the match. He didn't get up and were fidgety. He was just totally at ease.
Well, England were playing pretty well at that stage. They were a strong side, well led by Ray Illingworth. And so we were expecting a pretty tough contest. And we also knew from the selection of the England side, they had plenty of quick bowlers in the team. We'd faced John Snow in England in 68. We knew how good he was. And so we were expecting a pretty tough competition.
The opposition, media, terrible. They're probably even worse today, but they were terrible then. I mean, we were called Dad's Army. Soon as they saw us, they thought we were pretty rubbish. Raymond Illingworth was the captain, and he was 38. And Dolly Vera, Basil, was 39. Well, he's probably about 42, because I think he kidded everybody on for years, did Basil, so they never picked him for England, but he's a wonderful player. Edrich was 33, John Edrich, wonderful player. I was 30, Lucas was about 32. And for Australians, it's a kind of young country. They always think of young people, 20s. And so we were regarded as, hang on, are they going to beat us in Australia, in our own backyard? And we got called this Dad's Army, and they thought we weren't very good, to be honest, which was a mistake.
Yeah, that's pretty normal for the media and the public to be pretty one-eyed when it came to Australia versus England series. And then the other thing, in those days, there were quite a lot of lead-up matches to the Test series. And so they would have been playing a lot of state games. And the state sides were all very, very competitive. And I think there was almost the feeling in the state sides that if we play well against England, if we can happen to beat them, that'll help to deflate them a little bit and boost the Australian team's chances. So I can understand, from an English point of view, that they did feel that it was a bit tribal.
Bill Laurie had captained Australia for nearly 3 years. A gutsy competitor, he led from the front as one of his country's greatest opening batsmen. Colin Cowdrey had been England's first-choice captain and was widely expected to regain his position after returning from an Achilles injury. Ray Illingworth had stepped in for Cowdrey. The Yorkshireman, Illy, was in and out of England's Test setup. But against the West Indies in 1969 and in a Rest of the World game earlier in 1970, he'd secured his place.
We just had 16 players. We had a manager from Kent, David Clark was his name. When he was fit again at the end of the season, they'd expected that Colin would be captain, so they got a Kent manager, Kent captain. Didn't work out like that because the four selectors picked Raymond Illingworth because he did so good with the team against the Rest of the World. So here we had a down-to-earth Yorkshireman and a Kent guy. Well, it's difficult, but we had nobody else but Bernard Thomas was the physio, and he acted as assistant manager. And now they've got a head coach, a batting coach, a fielding coach, a bowling coach, Uncle Tom Cobbley, or a doctor, a vicar, of all sorts, haven't they? I mean, if I'd have been playing, you know, and they'd have sent all them out, I'd have had to clear the dressing room and said, look, you've got to go. We've got to have some space. I can't do with all you sat on the balcony in the dressing room. You've got to go. When you haven't all those coaches, you have to rely on each other, building together as a team, as a unit, because you didn't have videotape recording. So if you made a mistake and got out, or a guy bowled you out, and you want to know how did I miss that? How did I nick that to slip? You had to ask your mates, the guy who was at the other end, what did you see? What did I do wrong? Your guys in the pavilion, your teammates. And so you talk to each other about it.
In the early going of the series, we were a little bit light on for pace. Graham McKenzie, who was our best fast bowler, had got ill in India and really hadn't recovered properly and was never quite the same fast bowler again. Alan Froggy Thompson was his opening partner. Froggy was a decent bowler, but he bowled in-swing basically to right-handed batsmen. And I always felt that the Englishmen were pretty comfortable with the ball coming into them. And then we had Alan Connolly, who by that he started out as a fast bowler, but by that stage was more of a medium fast swing bowler. So pace was the thing that was really missing from that Australian bowling lineup. Bill Laurie, after the Indian series and when we arrived in South Africa, said that I was the best batsman in the world, which I thought was a silly statement, and it didn't really affect me because I didn't believe it anyhow. And then I had a horrible series in South Africa. But, you know, back home again, as I say, rested after a winter at home and playing on surfaces that I knew well, I was in pretty decent form coming into the Ashes series.
Ashes to Ashes.
The three tests before Sydney were unremarkable. There were draws at Brisbane and Perth, and 3 days of continuous rain caused Melbourne to be abandoned without a ball being played.
Well, first of all, I'd have to say, I don't think I was in great form the first two tests. Oh, I made 30 and about a 20 or something at Brisbane. That is all right. I was in great form in the state matches. Oh, I got 170 against South Australia. I got 100 in Melbourne. I got 100 in Sydney. I got 100 in Queensland against them before the test. But I didn't make a lot of runs in the test. And then I made 50 and 70-some in Perth, the first test that was ever played in Perth. Was in 70, and it was hard work making them. And then the rained off test in Melbourne, it rained every day, and my uncle wrote to me, and took forever to get an airmail letter those days, and no Skyping or anything, and told me to, he watched highlights that were always like 2 days later, weren't they, on BBC, said, you got to try and express yourself, I got to relax and express myself, and I always took his advice to heart. We didn't have videotape to watch. You get friends, or like my uncle would watch me and say, you don't look right, something's not right. I said, I know, but I don't know what it is, and he'd talk about it, and I'd have to work it out just through talking to him. So his letter come in and said, you've got to relax.
Well, it was a, you know, it was a pretty staid series up to that point. Three draws. I think both teams were probably expecting a result in Perth because the pitch had plenty of pace and bounce, but it perhaps was a little bit on the quiet side, the Perth pitch, maybe because it was the first ever test match in Perth. Maybe the curator didn't want the game to be finished quickly or to his pitch to be looked upon as a bad one. So maybe he sort of produced something that wasn't quite a normal whacker pitch. So really, the series hadn't been all that enterprising up until we got to Sydney. It was, the cricket was, a bit on the boring side.
In those days, overs were eight balls long, not six.
I loved eight ball overs. If I had a choice now today, I'd say eight ball overs. And the reason for that is, if you were a batsman playing well, you want the bowling. You don't want to be stood at the non-striker's end. So you've got the bowler by the scruff of the neck. You've got two more balls to be in control of him. On the other side, if you're a bowler working a batsman over and you think, you can get him out this, you want two more balls. You don't want the end of the over and somebody to get away to the other end. You want as many balls as you can.
After the third test washout at the MCG, the first ever one-day international was hastily arranged at the ground. Australia recorded a comfortable 5-wicket victory. Perhaps this series would catch fire after all. 4 days later, the stage was set for the fourth test at Sydney. England won the toss and elected to bat.
Well, first of all, it was a great pitch. It was dry, it had a bit of life early on for the quick bowlers, but then it turned. So you got the spinners in the game. We batted, you can tell, the totals weren't very big, actually. What do you mean, make 330? And they made 236, so we got a nice bit of a lead. One of the big factors was we couldn't read Johnny Gleeson. We just couldn't read him. He wasn't a wrist spinner like Shane Warne, fantastic bowler, but the wrist didn't come over. He had very long fingers, big hands, long fingers. He bowled the off spinner off the first finger, which is normal, but the leg spinner is off the ring finger and the wrist comes over. He didn't. He bowled the leg spinner off the middle finger. He kind of flicked it at you. So he flicked the off spin and flicked the leg spin, and oh, this was a nightmare trying to work him out. I used to work on that with Alan Knott. We weren't night outers and drinkers. We bit of room service and chat, and we had a tennis ball. And we're trying to work out to each other across the room what the hell Gleeson was bowling. God, it was a... I think back now and laugh at it. It was not funny. Let me tell you, trying to play a guy, you don't know which way the ball is going. Oh, he's not something you really want. And eventually, you then got it. I played against him and I thought, I'm sure that's it. That's it. And then when it is, and then you get confidence, I've got it. Once you got it then, it all came together in that Sydney Test match and I played out with my skin.
You know, I wasn't an opening batsman, and the stupid part about it is if anyone had asked me beforehand, the one thing that I didn't want to do was open the batting. I love batting at number three. I've always felt that to be a good opener, you've got to want to open, and I didn't want to open. And Bill said to me before the game, I think after the toss even, because England batted first, he said, oh, the selectors want you to open the batting. How do you feel about that? And I said, Bill, if you're asking for my opinion, I want to bat at number three. But I said, if you're the captain, if you tell me I've got to open, then I'll open. He said, I'll think about it. So he didn't say anything more to me until the end of the England innings. As we were walking off the field, he said, oh, by the way, you're opening. Now, it was a stupid decision because Keith Stackpole had made 200 opening the batting in the Brisbane test, which was the first one. Now, I'd got 50 in Brisbane, 50 in Perth, so I was in pretty decent form, batting at number three. I don't know what the hell their thinking was to change the batting order. As I say, it was a stupid decision. I didn't want to open, and consequently, I didn't play very well.
Chappell wasn't the only Australian to suffer. His brother Greg, recently named Australia's Sportsman of the Year ahead of Rod Laver, went for 15, caught and bowled by Derek Underwood. Deadly Derek was true to form, dismissing the heart of Australia's middle order. They were all out for 236. England now had 2.5 days to pile on the runs. Boycott stood firm, but after Brian Luckhurst went, he ran out John Edrich. By the time Keith Fletcher trudged back to the stands, there were only 48 runs on the board.
We were under pressure. The crucial period of the match was when D'Oliveira joined me, and I remember saying to him, listen, you're the last batsman, because we only played 5 batsmen, we played extra bowlers. I said, we're under pressure. He made 50-odd, and the captain made 50-odd not out, came in, and I made one of the best innings of my life.
Connolly it is now, bowling from the Randwick end to Boycott. Boycott on 99. And he pushes away on the onside. They've got one and they're going for two. It'll take Boycott to the coveted three figures, his first century in this Test series, and he's played a very, very good innings.
The top was going by that. I mean, the top's going, it's wearing. Some balls are beginning to take off. You're not getting the true bounce. And once the ball jags from side to side, okay, that's seam or swing. You don't get a lot of that in Australia because you get more pace. So you can do with less movement because you've got the extra pace and bounce. But once the ball goes up and down a bit and it's going sideways as well, then you've got a serious problem as a batsman. And it started to do both. It started to go up and down a bit. And I just played fantastic. Got 142 not out, and we fancied our chances then. We really did.
And here's the declaration. 5 down for 319, which gives England a lead of 415 runs.
Boycott's unbeaten 142 is an extremely valuable innings for England, who set Australia the mammoth task of batting 9 hours for a draw. And it was John Snow who bowled the first fiery over of the Australian innings to Bill Laurie.
If I did make any adjustments, they weren't very successful because I think my second innings lasted one ball. Because I didn't see myself as an opener, and I was certainly hoping it wasn't going to be a long-term proposition, I didn't make any changes at all to my batting style. I figured that if I could have success at number three, there wasn't much point in trying to change my style to open the batting. I probably wasn't in the best mental state, but I mean, that was my fault. If anything, I should have used it as motivation to play well, but perhaps in the back of my mind was the thought that if I played well opening, I might get the job permanently, which I didn't want. One, I thought it was a stupid move, and two, I didn't think and was certainly hoping it wasn't going to be a permanent move.
Like Boycott in England's second innings, opener Bill Laurie lasted the course throughout Australia's second go with the bat. In front of him, though, his team quickly fell. England's best fast bowler, John Snow, was largely responsible.
Now, as a player, you never think that you're beaten until you are actually beaten. I always thought that at that time, around that time, the Sydney pitch was the best cricket pitch in the world. It gave everybody a chance. But the thing about that Bulleye soil was that it used to crumble more so than the soils on all the other pitches. And that was one of the reasons why it was such a good cricket wicket, because it would crumble a bit and it would give the spinners in particular encouragement, particularly fourth and fifth day. But where John Snow was so great was he was quick, but he was also very accurate. And quite often, or on most occasions, you don't get fast bowlers who are really quick, but they're that accurate. And Snowy had spotted a little crumbling part of the pitch.
He was able to bowl just short of a length and get the ball to rear, to get it odd ones to bounce a bit. And that's more discomforting than faster bowlers throughout history. John had the ability to bowl just short of a length, cut the ball a bit, that means move it off the seam a bit, but he got this bounce into your ribs and into your heart area. Very awkward to play from there. The ball gets up to high chest, into your neck, your chin, that area, because it's very hard to get high enough to get over the ball and control keeping it down. And also, if it hits you in the ribs, by golly, it really hurts. Most people didn't wear chest pads then. They came in later. I didn't have a chest pad then. I did later. And so you've no muscle. You've no protection on your ribs. If it hits your ribs, it crack it, bruise it for weeks, and it's so painful. So when the ball's rearing into your ribs and your heart and your neck, and you have a man at boot hill, bat and pad, you have a man behind, it's very difficult and awkward, and he was a very awkward customer. He's a fine bowler.
Ashes to Ashes. Sydney 1971, with Geoffrey Boycott and Ian Chappell.
So Snow bowls to Connolly. And is he out? Yes, it's all over. He's caught. The wicket has fallen. Snow has taken 7 for 40. Connolly caught not. Bowl Snow, no score. The match is all over. McKenzie is not going to bat on, and Bill Laurie has batted right through the Australian innings. A wonderful performance by him.
Snow finished the innings with 7 for 40. Along with Boycott's 142, two of England's more single-minded personalities had earned them a winning margin of 299 runs. It was their biggest victory in Australia since 1936. They had finally broken through. 1-0 up in the series, with three tests to play.
We lost very badly. Bill Laurie, he batted right through that innings when the rest of us all fell like ninepins, and he carried his bat. He was a very, very gutsy player. You know, he took a few on the body from John Snow, but you couldn't frighten Bill out of anything. He was a very tough competitor. Really, apart from Bill, the rest of us didn't put up much of a show at all. I was one of those sort of players who, it took me a couple of hours to wind down after a day's play. But the mood wouldn't have been great from memory. None of us liked being beaten. But it wasn't a down in the dumps feeling. It was, okay, we're one down. We got to win the next one and get back level. I tended to take the attitude, and I remember saying to Rodney Marsh at one stage or other, now, when you win, you drink to celebrate. When you lose, you drink to commiserate. And I said, after you've had four beers, you're not sure which one it is anyhow.
I can remember after we won in Sydney, that test, we went to see Jose Feliciano, one of the theatres there. We all went together. I thought, you know, I didn't start till I don't know what time, and he didn't come on till like late at night, and the whole team, come on, Fire. I said, I'm going to go to bed. No, no, Fire, you've got to come celebrate. So I did. And it's fun. I mean, yeah, went out to dinner a lot, lots of lovely restaurants and so forth. But no, I just concentrated on the cricket.
There were two more draws at Melbourne and Adelaide, where Tests 5 and 6 were played only 3 days apart. With England clinging to their 1-0 advantage, Australia needed to make a change.
I was in Adelaide in a hotel having a counter lunch when I got a call from one of the Adelaide journalists, and he said, congratulations. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, you're captain of Australia. And I said, you're bloody joking, mate. And he said, no, you're captain. They've sacked Bill. So that was the first thing. It was a shock to me. Secondly, it was disgraceful the way that Bill found out. Apparently, they were still in the hotel in Adelaide on the morning when he was sacked, and Keith Stackpole heard it on the radio and went and told Bill. Bill didn't know. Now, Bill Laurie, you know, whatever they thought of his captaincy, Bill Laurie had given wonderful service to Australia, and he deserved to be told face-to-face by one of the selectors.
In a waterlogged one day before the final Sydney test, Boycott broke his arm at the SCG. He would play no part in the decider.
Fantastic test match. And again, because of the rain, there I was in the dressing room all the time with my arm in a sling, and the operator and put me in hospital. Then I came out, watched the test from the dressing room. I could take an objective view, but it was a very low-scoring game because the test pitcher had no preparation too. And the scores were like 200, just over 200. Nobody made a lot of runs. It was very tense and everything, and Snow went down to fine leg, and they were pelting him with tin cans and all sorts of things, and rain was irate. Duff was coming on the field being thrown, and he said, right, he asked the umpires to sort it out, and they didn't. So he said, right, let's go off. And they all came in the dressing room, and oh, Christ, there was hell on. We did feel discriminated against. In six test matches, we didn't get one LBW against them. And also, we had two umpires quite a lot of the time. Lou Rowan was an ex-policeman and is quite officious. He wasn't good at handling people. And the other guy who was good, Tom Brooks, good umpire, but good at handling people as well. Lou was pretty tough. I'm not saying he was a cheat or he was unfair, but it was hard to get to like him. It's hard to feel that we will be getting a fair shake of it with him.
A testy atmosphere between the two sides and the umpires had come to a head. In the field, Snow had been grabbed by an Australian spectator with such force that others had to peel the angry Aussie away. The threat of forfeit coaxed Illingworth and his side back onto the field. But Snow didn't last the distance after breaking his finger just two overs into Australia's second innings.
Snowy took no part, but what they didn't realise was we had two quality spinners when it turned, and it was Illingworth and Underwood that won the match for England, getting 7 or 8 wickets. And it was a magical time, and I'd say to anybody, if you get a chance to see a low-scoring match go, it's far more interesting than any high-scoring match where you see batsmen make hundreds and fifties. It's when you make 40. And out of 250 or 220, those are the real tense, pressurised moments. And it was a fantastic test match.
Well, it was deflating to lose the final test and lose the Ashes series. But, you know, after you go through all the recriminations and so on, after about half an hour, you start to be a bit more honest. And I think by that stage I was feeling, well, we were beaten by the better side. England were definitely the better side.
England had won by 62 runs to take the series 2-0. A remarkable Ashes success for Illingworth and his side in a series of unprecedented length and bitter exchanges. They became the only touring team to play a full test series in Australia without defeat, and the Ashes came back to England after an absence of 14 years.
We deserve to win it. He caught well, the spinners did well, the batsmen fought like hell in the second innings. Nobody made a lot, 30s, 40s, everybody working hard because we were under the cosh. We were about 70, 80 behind on first innings, which is usually that's a lot on a low-scoring game. But they all went in and made a few runs. At the end of the game, spontaneously, the players picked Hilly up on their shoulders. They just picked him up. Magical moment. I mean, nobody told him to do that. He didn't even know we were going to win. And that said everything. He didn't need to say any more. That he just had a way of thinking ahead from the cricket point of view.
I learned a lot about captaincy from Ray Illingworth. He was a good, tough competitor. And you could have a good game of cricket with Ray. And he also, I think the smartest thing he did on that tour was the way that he handled John Snow. Snowy was a terrific bowler. He was a very single-minded guy, and Illy knew exactly how to handle him, when to push him and when to give him a bit of space. And he handled him well, and John Snow, I'm sure, appreciated that, and it showed up in his performance. So it was a good side, very well led.
It was a period when I played exceptionally well. I was coming to my best years. I think I averaged 93 in the series. And we won, because making runs, taking wickets, and you don't win is not the same fun, let me tell you. So you want to do well individually, but then winning. And we won, and we deserve to win. Against all the odds, all the criticism about our age and everything, because we had some really top players. John Edrich, Basil D'Oliveira, we had the young Bob Willis game, Snow was a great bowler, Underwood, and Knott was the greatest wicketkeeper I've ever seen. We had some top players.
With thanks to Paul Hayward and Sheil Berry, Ashes to Ashes is produced by Kate Borsay. As soon as they're released, the other episodes in this five-part series will be available on iTunes, where you can leave us a review or go to telegraph.co.uk. Ashes to Ashes is a production by The Telegraph.